key injuries during spring training. Gerrit Cole, last year's American League Cy Young Award winner, is set to begin the season on the injured list due to nerve irritation and edema in his throwing elbow, forcing the Yankees to navigate the March-April gauntlet without their steady innings-earning ace. Leadoff hitter DJ LeMahieu's opening day status remains unclear after a foul ball off his right foot left him with, as manager Aaron Boone described it, a pretty significant bone bruise. Aaron Judge says he'll be ready to go after going through an abdominal discomfort this month that cost him more than a week of spring training and put him behind schedule. A fast start would help the Yankees further distance themselves from last year's disappointing 82-80 campaign, but again, it won't be easy. Nestor Cortez is set to open the opening day game on March 28th in Houston, where he's in line to face Astros lefty Framber Valdez. Cortez last pitched on August 5th, coincidentally against the Astros, before a rotator cuff strain ended his 2023 season early. And I'm just going to read a couple notes from the Mets. The 2024 schedule presents the Mets with prime opportunities to pick up some early wins, but gets much harder in a hurry. Four of the Mets' first five opponents are projected to win fewer than 80 games, according to Baseball Prospectus PECOTA sabermetric system. First up are the depleted Milwaukee Brewers, who open the season with a three-game series at Citi Field beginning on March 28th. The Brewers won 92 games in the National League Central last season, but traded away ace Corbin Burns in the offseason and are expected to be without fellow frontline starter Brandon Woodruff for most of, if not all, 2024 as he recovers from shoulder surgery. The Brew crew also lost President of Baseball Operations David Stearns to the Mets and manager Craig Counsell to the Chicago Cubs. Following the mass exodus, the Brewers are expected to win only 79 games in 2024, fewer than the Mets in 83. And one more note here. After hosting Milwaukee from March 28th to 31st with a March 29th off day, the Mets welcome the Detroit Tigers, who won 78 games last season but are projected for three fewer victories this year from April 1st to the 3rd. The Mets then embark on their first road trip with stops in Cincinnati, April 5th to the 7th, in Atlanta, April 8th to the 11th. The up-and-coming Reds at 82-80 flirted with a wild-card spot last season, but fell just short. And we don't have much on the air today. There's NIT action. That's UNLV at Seton Hall. That's the quarterfinal in St. Joseph, Missouri. That's on ESPN2. Another game, St. Joseph, Missouri, NIT tournament, VCU at Utah. In the NBA, there are two games, L.A. Clippers at the Philadelphia 76ers, that's on ESPN, and at 10:05 p.m., Phoenix at Denver, ESPN, and there is one NHL hockey game that is the Boston Bruins at the Tampa Bay Lightning, that's 7:30 p.m. on TNT. That's it for the sports for today. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
Thanks for spending this part of your day with Chris, Connecticut's Talking Newsstand.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup. I'm Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 27th. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Current, and we will take a look at the pictures on the front pages of each paper. The main picture on the front of the Times is a picture of the bridge that collapsed. It was hit by a vessel bound for Sri Lanka. It caused the 1.6-mile Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore to fall early Tuesday. I think it happened about 1:30 in the morning. It says at least two construction workers were rescued. I'm not sure how many lost their lives. It may be in the article. I'm going to read that. And the picture is that of the ship hitting the bridge, and it's beginning its collapse. There are six other small pictures giving the sequence of what happened tells the time. At 1:27 a.m., the ship changed direction as it neared one of the bridge's piers. The bridge is intact at that point. Secondly, at 1:28, the ship hit one of the bridge's two main piers. Still, the bridge looks like it's intact. 1:28 a.m., southern and central spans collapsed within seconds of impact. You can see the beginning of the collapse. And then the worst of the three pictures, 1:28, the northern span began to collapse seconds later. And then the last two pictures at 1:28 a.m., within 30 seconds of impact, the main spans had fully collapsed and the bridge was almost completely submerged. So we're going to have that story first. Over to the Hartford Courant, a more pleasant story. There's a lady named Samantha Cross of Watertown, and she is skating around the Farmington Canal Heritage Trail near the parking area on Railroad Avenue on Tuesday in Cheshire as she gets ready for a 7-mile workout along the trail. She skates 7 miles. And there are three pictures. The main one is her on her skates ready to go. And then underneath, there's a picture of her putting on her skates. And the third one is a picture of her tying her skates. So that's it. We're going to start with the story on the bridge. I'll read quite a bit of it because it certainly was the biggest news yesterday. As a spring tide rests out of Baltimore Harbor just after midnight on Tuesday, the hulking outlines of a cargo ship nearly 3 football fields long and stacked high with thousands of containers sliced through frigid waters toward the Francis Scott Key Bridge. The vessel, the Dali, it's D-A-L-I, was a half hour into its 27-day journey from Baltimore to Colombo, Sri Lanka. Then the lights on the dolly went dark. The crew urgently reported to local authorities that they had lost power and propulsion. The ship bore down on the bridge. In a scene captured from a live streaming camera, the ship smashed into a pillar of the bridge with so much force that the massive southern and central spans of the bridge collapsed within seconds. A highway repair crew was on the structure working the night shift, filling potholes. At least 8 members of the construction crew plunged into the 50-foot-deep Patapesco River below. 6 were still missing by the early evening as search crews scoured the waters by boat and helicopter. 2 construction workers were rescued from the water, and 1 went to the hospital early on Tuesday morning. He had been released by Tuesday afternoon. The spectacular collapse of the 1.6-mile bridge seared into the memories of the countless people who viewed video of the ship bearing down on the bridge was described by officials as an accident. This is a quote now coming up from the governor, Wes Moore of Maryland. We haven't seen any credible evidence of a terrorist attack. The governor praised the work of quick-acting officials who rushed to stop traffic from entering the doomed bridge, mitigating what could have been a far deadlier disaster. President Biden announced that the Port of Baltimore would be closed indefinitely, although ranked only the 17th biggest port in the nation overall. In 2021, it specializes in vehicles. The port ranks first in the United States for the volume of automobiles and light trucks, and experts said its closure could affect deliveries, including of farm and construction machinery. Around the world, about 40 ships, including 34 cargo vessels, had Baltimore listed as a destination on Tuesday, including 10 commercial ships with anchors dropped in nearby waters, according to Marine Traffic, a maritime data platform that tracks ships. The Key Bridge, which experts said would take years to replace, was a major north-south artery, and its collapse wiped out a roadway that tens of thousands of people used to travel to and from Baltimore every day. The bridge carried more than 12.4 million commercial and passenger vehicles in 2023, according to a Maryland state government report issued last November. President Biden called the bridge, quote, one of the most important elements supporting the U.S. economy in the Northeast, and said he expected the federal government to pay for the entire cost of bridge repairs. Jennifer Homedy, chairwoman of the National Transportation Safety Board, said that the agency would lead the investigation into the cause of the bridge collapse. The agency is standing back to allow the search and rescue team to continue its efforts, but a team of 24 people will be gathering information from the command center until they can get into the scene directly, she said. A construction company employee who labored alongside the six missing men said many of his co-workers were migrants working to support their relatives. We're low-income families, said the worker Jesus Campos. Our relatives are waiting for our help back in our home countries. Underwater drones deployed on Tuesday showed an abundance of twisted metal and debris from the collapsed bridge, making it unsafe for divers to explore the wreckage. Angela Usabrox, the county executive for Prince George's County in Maryland, said in a social media post. The collapse of the bridge, which opened in 1977 and is named after Francis Scott Key, the Maryland-born author of the American National Anthem, immediately raised questions about what caused the ship to lose power at a critical moment, about the procedures of guiding massive vessels out of the harbor, and whether the design of the bridge made it more susceptible to collapse. There were also questions about the possible steps that might have been taken to prevent the accident in seconds before it occurred. Harbor pilots and crews of many large ships have two anchors ready to drop as they enter or leave a harbor in case an emergency such as a loss of power requires them to try to stop quickly. Well, that procedure is more common for tankers than container ships, according to Basil M. Karzas, the chief executive at Karzas Marine Advisors, a ship inspection company in New York. He says the anchors have to be unlocked and ready to be dropped, and this takes some time to prepare. It's generally crew members physically at the bow have to unlock them and release them. That's not something you can do in an emergency. So we're going to stop there, and we will go on to another story that's on the front page of the New York Times. The story from Washington, a majority of the Supreme Court appeared deeply skeptical of efforts to severely curtail access to a widely used abortion pill, questioning whether a group of anti-abortion doctors and organizations had a right to challenge the Food and Drug Administration approval of the medication. Over nearly 2 hours of argument, justices across the ideological spectrum seemed likely to side with the federal government, with only two justices, the conservatives Samuel A. Alito Jr. and possibly Clarence Thomas, appearing to favor limits on the distribution of the pill. Describing the case as an effort by a handful of individuals, Justice Neil M. Gorsuch raised whether it would stand as a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action. The challenge involves mifepristone. I'm going to spell M-I-F-E-P-R-I-S-T-O-N-E, mifepristone, and that's a drug approved by the FDA more than two decades ago that is used in nearly two-thirds of abortions in the country. At issue is whether the agency acted appropriately in expanding access to the drug in 2016 and again in 2021 by allowing doctors to prescribe it through telemedicine and to send the pills by mail. The Biden administration had asked the Supreme Court to intervene after a three-judge panel of a federal appeals court favored curbing distribution of the drug. Until the justices decide, access to mifepristone remains unchanged, delaying the potential for abrupt limits on its availability. Even if the court preserves full access in mifepristone, the pills will remain illegal in more than a dozen states that have enacted near-total abortion bans. Those bans do not distinguish between medication and surgical abortion. The case brought the issue of abortion access back to the Supreme Court, even as the conservative majority had said in the case that overturned Roe v. Wade, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, that it would cede the question to the people and their elected representatives. Justice Gorsuch's pointed questioning was echoed by other justices who asked whether any of the doctors involved in the lawsuit could show they were harmed by the federal government approval and regulation of the abortion drug. In one instance, Justice Elena Kagan asked the lawyer for the anti-abortion groups whom they were relying on to show an actual injury. You need a person, Justice Kagan said. So who's your person? Although the argument contain detailed descriptions of abortion, including questions about placental tissue and bleeding, the focus on whether the challengers were even entitled to sue suggested that the justices could rule for the FDA without addressing the merits of the case. Since the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade ended a nationwide right in place for nearly a half century, abortion pills have increasingly become the center of political and legal fights. In a related story, bearing colorful signs and banners that read "Doctors, not doctrine, and abortion is healthcare," hundreds of activists chanted, marched, and rallied for hours outside the Supreme Court starting Tuesday morning before the justices weighed the availability of a commonly used abortion pill. Supporters of abortion rights outnumbered those opposing abortion, but the two factions occasionally sparred with rallying calls, including over the safety of the pill, mifepristone. Studies show that it is, in fact, safe for terminating a pregnancy. Some had traveled across the country to demonstrate. Courtney Brown, a coffee shop owner who helped found an abortion rights group in Amarillo, Texas, where the case originated, described her town as ground zero in the fight over abortion. She added, "I'm just ready to fight back because we're so tired of having those rights stripped away." Circling the court were a handful of small spherical robots containing abortion pills, remotely operated and called Roe-Bots. That's R-O-E-B-O-T-S. That's a play on Wade versus Roe. Potential recipient would use the robot to complete a telehealth consultation with a provider in a state where the pill is legal, and the machine would dispense a pill. Three medical students from New York company the robots emphasize the importance of the case as future doctors and OBGYNs who risk facing restrictions on reproductive care. Supreme Court justices didn't go to medical school, said Sarah McNeely, a student at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. "You should trust and depend on the FDA, which is a world-class institution filled with brilliant people who are very committed to their jobs, and you should let them do that, and stop trying to politicize science." About 13 abortion rights activists were arrested for violating a law against crowding, obstructing, or incoming to the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. According to the Capitol Police, the arrests were part of a plan of civil disobedience meant to underscore the wide-ranging consequences of the case, which could sharply curtail access to the pill and undercut the regulatory authority of the FDA. Getting arrested was intended to match the severity of the threat to reproductive rights, said Rachel O'Leary Carmona, executive director of the Women's March, who was among the 13 detained. And we're going to stop for the weather report. First, I have the national forecasts from the New York Times, and then the local forecast. Here's the national forecast. A strong storm will push showers into the eastern Great Lakes in the northeast today. Farther south, rain and thunderstorms will occur along the Atlantic coast. Thunderstorms could become severe from southern South Carolina to northern Florida and may bring damaging wind gusts and flooding downpours. Heavy rain may develop late at night from the Carolinas to southeastern Pennsylvania and could lead to ponding on roadways. Another storm will bring rain to the northwest. Rain will spread farther south into northern California by the afternoon. With the exception of afternoon thunderstorms in parts of Texas and Oklahoma, most places across the center of the nation will be dry.
For helpful tips on using assistive computer technology, listen Monday afternoons at 2 for the Keystrokes Computer Hour on Chris.
The forecast for tonight has rain likely, otherwise cloudy, with a low around 46. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Tomorrow, Thursday, rain is likely, otherwise cloudy, with a high near 52. Chance of precipitation is 60%. And tomorrow night, rain is likely, It'll be cloudy with a low around 37. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Friday, there's a slight chance of rain, partly sunny, with a high near 50. Chance of precipitation is 20%. And Friday night will be partly cloudy, with a low around 35. Saturday will be sunny, with a high near 54. And Saturday night, mostly cloudy, with a low around 36. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
And now we're going to move over to the Hartford Courant. I have some stories that are on the front page. We'll start with this one. When faced with pleas to extend Connecticut's free school meal program, leaders of the Appropriations Committee encouraged testifiers at a public hearing Tuesday to go back to their districts and tap into federal COVID relief funds. The committee chairs expressed resistance to HB 5510, a bill that would renew the $11.2 million program that has provided free breakfast for all students and free lunch to families who qualify for free or reduced price meals through the 2023-2024 school year. Universal free meal proponents came out to support the bill Tuesday in an emotional public hearing that included students, educators, lawmakers, social workers, and food service directors. Highlighting the impact of free meals on improving educational outcomes, engagement, mental health, nutrition, school climate, and other benefits, the supporters urged committee members to pass the bill and keep kids fed. But with millions of expiring elementary and secondary school emergency relief fund dollars on the table, some lawmakers appeared skeptical of increasing state spending to sustain the program. We want to make sure that when you go back that you're saying to your school system, if you have not spent this money by September 1st or allocated the money by September 1st, it will be returned to the federal government. If you have no place for this money to go, it should go into the school meal program as a way to foster funding for this, Committee Chair Senator Kathy Austin said. Nearly $337 million in ESSER funds remain unspent across Connecticut's public and charter schools, according to data collected by the Connecticut State Department of Education. ESSER balances in each district range from $0 to $57.7 million, with a median of approximately, as boards of education prepare their budgets for next year, Representative Moira Rader said that districts are desperately trying to avoid staff layoffs and maintain programs for their students, not discussing how to use ESSER to extend the state's meal program. A lot of town budgets are going to fail this year, said Rader, who testified in favor of HB 5510 and is a member of the Guilford Board of Education. The issue around ESSER is that it's a great gift right now, but it's going to go away. So if you have something that you want to sustain beyond next year, you really don't want to budget it using ESSER funding. Committee leaders argued that cafeteria funding is an appropriate ESSER expense, and that if districts want to prioritize free meals, they should do it with the remaining funds. They need to expend their money before the state comes in, Committee Chair Representative Tony Walker said in an interview after the hearing. And back to the front page for this story. Hartford is set to raise the Christian flag over City Hall after a contentious debate over what flags should be flown on city property. The resolution introduced by Council Democrats calls for the historical white and blue flag with a red Latin cross to be flown on Thursday in observance of Holy Week before Easter Sunday. The flag, designed over a century ago, represents all Christian denominations. The flag raising comes after Hartford and numerous towns across the state have passed policies restricting what flags can be flown on municipal flagpoles. Strict flag policies, now commonplace across the state, have sparked controversy in several towns over what flags should or should not be flown on municipal property. Several towns have outright banned the Pride flag and the POW/MIA flag while allowing only official government flags to be flown. Proponents of flag policies have said they are necessary to avoid lawsuits. Hartford opted not to adopt an official policy last year after the U.S. Supreme Court found that the city of Boston violated a private organization's First Amendment right by refusing to raise the Christian flag at City Hall, given that they had allowed other flags in the past and that the city did not have a policy in place. Instead, Hartford's new flag policy, which was unanimously adopted Monday evening, will allow flags of other nations, flags of sports teams, and flags displayed in conjunction with official events or ceremonies to be flown at City Hall. The ordinance does not expressly prohibit religious flags from flying on city property. And while the policy is more inclusive than several other towns in recent years, it still prohibits flagpoles as a form of public expression. Instead of citizens requesting what flags can be flown, council members are the only ones that can decide what flags can fly. This is really the crux of the policy position that was drafted into this, said the city's corporation council. Jonathan Harding, Flagpoles are not a form of public expression. They are a form of city expression. But the decision to fly the Christian flag over City Hall was met with some opposition. Democratic council members who supported the resolution included Council President Shirley Surgeon, Mally Rosado, Marilyn Rossetti, Amilcar Hernandez, and Thomas T.J. Clark II, and Kelly Bilodeau, as well as Working Families Party member and Pastor Alex Thomas, Working Families Party member Josh McTom, and John Gale of the Hartford Party both opposed the flag raising. "We have many Christian organizations that serve the residents of the city. We're just recognizing those organizations and the work they do," said Surgeon, who co-sponsored the resolution. "We want to show that we recognize them and what they provide to residents of Hartford." And we have one more story on the front page of The Current. Hate groups and their propaganda are thriving in Connecticut, according to a new report by the Anti-Defamation League Center of Extremism, released Tuesday. The report shows white supremacist propaganda increased in the state in 2023 with 235 incidents, a 17.5% increase over 2022 in a 115% rise since 2017. There were just two incidents in 2017, the ADL said. The propaganda, including flyers, stickers, graffiti, posters, and laser projections, target blacks, Jews, LGBTQ people, and non-white groups. White supremacy is a term used to characterize belief systems where whites should have dominance over people of other backgrounds, that whites should find themselves in a white-only society, that white people have a culture of their own that is superior to other cultures, and that white people are genetically superior to other people. Those are the tenets of white supremacy, said Stacy Sobel, regional director for the ADL in Connecticut. The most active group is the Patriot Front, which the ADL said was allegedly responsible for 60% of propaganda actions nationally. It was allegedly responsible for 196 incidents in Connecticut in 2023. "They believe that their ancestors conquered America and bequeathed it to them," Sobel said, "and they justify their ideology of hate under the guise of preserving the ethnic and cultural origin of its members and European ancestors." She said the Patriot Front makes their flyers and stickers look patriotic if you didn't really know what they were looking at. They make them red, white, and blue. It's only when you go to their website and dig into it that you really see. Others are the New England Nationalist Social Club, also known as 131 Crew, which Sobel said is the second most active group in Connecticut, allegedly responsible for 20 incidents in the Iron Circle, with two alleged incidents. In 2023, white supremacist propaganda was reported in the District of Columbia and every U.S. state except Hawaii and Alaska, the ADL found. Behind all this is the great replacement theory, Sobel said. She referred to the 2017 Charlottesville, Virginia rally where they chanted, "Jews will not replace us," she said. And that's referring to the great replacement theory, which accuses Jews globally, its democratic leaders and others, using democratic institutions and processes to eliminate white Christian Americans. You can also say that of many of the mass shootings that have happened over the last several years, Sobel said, they all harken black to white supremacist propaganda. And those include the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shooting, the Buffalo, New York supermarket shooting, and the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, she said. If you examined the social media of all these shooters, the mass shooters involved, they all share manifestos citing white supremacist jargon, Sobel said. And we are going to move on now to the World and Nation section of the Current. And we have this story. This is from Oakland, California. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. chose Nicole Shanahan on Tuesday to be his vice presidential pick, as he mounts an independent White House bid that has spooked national Democrats. Shanahan, 38, is a California lawyer and philanthropist who has never held elected office. Shanahan leads BioEcho Foundation, an organization she founded to direct money toward issues including women's reproductive science, criminal justice reform, and environmental causes. Kennedy, a former Democrat, made the announcement in Oakland. Nicole and I both left the Democratic Party, he said. Our values didn't change. The Democratic Party did. Shanahan, who grew up in Oakland, mentioned her humble childhood and affluence as an adult. The purpose of wealth is to help those in need. That's what it's for, she said Tuesday. And I want to bring that back to politics, too. Without the backing of a party, Kennedy faces an arduous task to get on the ballot with varying rules across the 50 states. He's picking a running mate now because about half of the states require him to designate one before he can apply for ballot access. Kennedy has secured access to the ballot in Utah. He and an ally super PAC, American Values 2024, say they've collected enough signatures to qualify in several other states, including swing states Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, but election officials there have not yet signed off. He began his campaign as a primary challenge to Biden, but last fall said he'd run as an independent instead. Kennedy was a teen when his father was assassinated during his own presidential campaign in 1968. And we have a story from New York. A New York judge on Tuesday issued a gag order barring former President Donald Trump from commenting publicly about witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors in his upcoming hush money criminal trial, citing Trump's history of threatening, inflammatory, denigrating remarks about people in his legal cases. Judge Juan M. Merchant's decision, echoing a gag order in Trump's Washington, D.C. election interference criminal case, came a day after he rejected the defense's push to delay the Manhattan trial until summer in order to begin April 15th. If that date holds, it will be the first criminal trial of a former president. Given that the eve of trial is upon us, it is without question that the imminency of the risk of harm is now paramount, Merchant wrote in a four-page decision granting the prosecution's request for what it deemed a narrowly tailored gag order. The judge said the presumptive Republican presidential nominee's statements have induced fear and necessitated added security measures to protect his targets and investigate threats. Trump's lawyers fought a gag order, warning it would amount to unconstitutional and unlawful prior restraint on his free speech rights. Merchant, who had long resisted imposing the gag order, said his obligation to ensuring the integrity of the trial outweighed First Amendment concerns. President Trump's political opponents have and will continue to attack him based on this case, Trump lawyers Todd Blanche and Susan Nickley said in a recent court filing. The voters have the right to listen to President Trump's unfettered responses to those attacks, and not just one side of that debate. The gag order bars Trump from either making or directing other people to make public statements on his behalf about potential witnesses and jurors in the hush money trial. It also prohibits any statements meant to interfere with or harass the court staff, prosecution team, or their families. It does not bar comments about Merchan, whom Trump referred to after his arraignment last year, as a Trump-hating judge with a family full of Trump haters, or Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, an elected Democrat, but it puts Trump on notice that attacks on key figures in the case, like his former lawyer-turned-member nemesis Michael Cohen or porn star Stormy Daniels, won't be tolerated. A violation could result in Trump being held in contempt of court, fined, or even jailed. I want to thank Judge Merchan for imposing the gag order, as I have been under relentless assault from Donald's MAGA supporters, said Cohen, a key prosecution witness against Trump. Nevertheless, knowing Donald as well as I do, he will seek to defy the gag order by employing others within his circle to do his bidding, regardless of consequence. And we have a story from Jerusalem. The Israeli military pressed on with its bombardment of the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, signaling that the passing of a United Nations resolution calling for a ceasefire for the holy month of Ramadan the day before had not shaken Israel's determination to keep fighting. The military said its fighter jets had struck over 60 targets in Gaza over the previous day. It added that its forces were also operating in central Gaza, where they had killed a number of terrorists. WAFA, the Palestinian Authority news agency, said Tuesday that the Israeli military had struck residential homes and buildings and that dozens of people were killed. In a statement, the Israeli military added that it was continuing its operational activity around Al-Amal Hospital and the town of Al-Qarara in the Khan Yunis area of southern Gaza, adding that its forces were eliminating terrorists and carrying out targeted raids on terrorist infrastructure. Al-Amal Hospital went out of service Monday night after Israeli forces besieged it a day earlier and forced everyone out before closing off its entrances with earthen barriers, according to the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which runs the hospital. The organization said Monday that two people were killed and three others wounded when Israeli forces opened fire as they were being evacuated. The Israeli military also said Tuesday that it was pressing on with its assault on Shifa Hospital in the north for a ninth day. It said its forces there had, quote, located weapons and eliminated several terrorists, unquote. From Raleigh, North Carolina, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris on Tuesday promoted their health care agenda in the battleground state of North Carolina, arguing that Democrats, like themselves, would preserve access to care while Republicans would reverse gains made over the past decade and a half. 14 years after President Barack Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, the White House still sees health care as a winning issue during a campaign in which Biden has sometimes found himself on the defensive when it comes to immigration or the economy. Republicans have opposed Biden's signature initiatives to lower medical costs, and they've seized opportunities to restrict abortion rights after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. It's sick. Now they want to, quote his words, terminate the ACA, as my predecessor did, Biden said, referring to former President Donald Trump. If that were ever to happen, we'd also terminate a lot of lives as well. But we're not going to let that happen, are we? We're not going to let that happen. North Carolina was Biden's final stop on a tour of battleground states after his State of the Union address this month, which jump-started a frenzied travel schedule as the Democratic president makes his case for a second term and may likely rematch with Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee. The state is also a health care success story for the president. The American Rescue Plan, a coronavirus pandemic recovery measure signed by Biden, included financial incentives for states to expand Medicaid coverage for low-income residents. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat, used the money, which amounted to $1.8 billion, to persuade Republican lawmakers to support his plan. More than 600,000 residents are expected to qualify. Biden and Harris visited hours after the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case about access to mifepristone, a widely used abortion pill. The justices appeared inclined to preserve access to the medication. The White House has tried to make mifepristone more available as one of its few opportunities to protect women's ability to end their pregnancies. And our next story is from New York. NBC News has scrapped its plan to make former Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel an on-air contributor to its political coverage. After listening to the legitimate concerns of many of you, I have decided that Ronna McDaniel will not be an NBC News contributor, NBC News Group Chairman Cesar Conde says Tuesday in a memo to staff. The decision to reverse course comes after a stunning rebuke of the plan by the division's on-air talent. On Monday, nearly every opinion host on NBC's cable news channel MSNBC blasted the hiring of McDaniel because of her defense of former President Donald Trump's false claims of fraud in the 2020 election. The fact that McDaniel is on the payroll at NBC News, to me, that is inexplicable, Rachel Maddow said on her MSNBC program. You wouldn't hire a wise guy, you wouldn't hire a madman like a mobster to work in a DA's office. The onslaught of internal criticism of McDaniel came immediately after the announcement Friday that she would appear on political coverage across NBC news platforms, including MSNBC. McDaniel appeared on the Sunday edition of NBC's Meet the Press, where moderator Kristen Walker pressed her on her positions regarding Trump's continued belief that the 2020 election was stolen from him due to voter fraud. McDaniel, for the first time publicly, acknowledged that President Joe Biden won the election fair and square. She also broke with Trump's plan to pardon the January 6, 2021 rioters who had been convicted in prison. But her credibility was questioned Sunday by former Meet the Press moderator Chuck Todd in the panel discussion after Welker's interview. And I have a couple of news briefings. Ukraine has sunk or disabled a third of all Russian warships in the Black Sea in just over 2 years of war, Navy spokesman Dmytro Potenchuk said Tuesday, a heavy blow to Moscow's military capability. Potenchuk said the latest strike Saturday night hit the Russian amphibious landing ship Kasyantan Oshansky, which was docked in Sevastopol in Russia-occupied Crimea. The ship was part of the Ukrainian Navy before Russia captured it while annexing the Black Sea Peninsula in 2014. Potenchuk has previously announced that two other landing ships of the same type, Azov and Yamal, also were damaged in Saturday's strike, along with Ivan Kerr's intelligence ship. He said the weekend attack, which was launched with Ukraine-built Neptune missiles, also hit Sevastopol port facilities and an oil depot. Russian authorities reported a massive Ukrainian attack on Sevastopol over the weekend, but didn't acknowledge any damage to the fleet. Successful Ukrainian drone and missile strikes have provided a major morale boost for Kyiv at a time when its undermanned and outgunned forces are facing Russian attacks along the more than 600-mile front line. And I have one more news briefing. A Moscow court Tuesday ordered Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershovich, 32, to remain in jail on espionage charges until at least June 30th, court officials said. The U.S. citizen was arrested in late March 2023 while on a reporting trip and has spent nearly a year behind bars. Gershovich and his employer have denied the allegations, and the U.S. government has declared him to be wrongfully detained. And we are going to move over now to the Connecticut section of the Current for the rest of our stories. And the first one I have is this one. State police warn about pig butchering scams. Connecticut State Police are warning residents of a growing fraud trend known as pig butchering. State Police issued an advisory on Tuesday altering the public of this to this type of scam, which often uses a ruse involving a purported investment opportunity or a romantic interest. The term pig butchering refers to the scammer's practice of fattening up the victim with promises of wealth before slaughtering them by stealing their money, State Police wrote in a statement. It is crucial for the public to be aware of these scams, to be cautious of unsolicited investment advice from online acquaintances, and to thoroughly research any investment opportunity before committing funds. According to state police, pig butchering, which is known as sha zu pan in Chinese, usually involves someone contacting a potential victim through dating apps, social media, or professional networking platforms. After building trust with the victim over weeks or months, often feigning romantic interest or establishing a friendly rapport, the victim is emotionally invested enough for the scammer to introduce them to what is purported to be a lucrative investment opportunity involving cryptocurrency, foreign exchange trading, or a new venue, state police said. The scammer often claims to have insider knowledge of the phony investment opportunity and convinces the victim to invest their personal funds. The scammer may direct the victim to a fraudulent trading platform or app, which appears to show impressive returns on their investment, state police said. Encouraged by these fake profits, the victim is lured into investing more money. However, when the victim attempts to withdraw their funds, they discover that the platform is a sham and their money is lost. According to the FBI's Internet Crimes Complaint Center, cryptocurrency investment fraud grew more than 53% in 2023, approximately $4.5 billion, state police noted. However, that a recent study suggests this type of fraud may be far worse, with total losses since 2021 being possibly as high as $75 billion. Authorities also noted that scammers are often victims of human trafficking who deal with poor living and working conditions. And we're going to take our final break and be back with the rest of the front pages after that.
Since multiple sclerosis is a central nervous system disease that isolates people and destroys connections, it's fitting that connection could be its greatest enemy. As connections form among people with MS and their families, they end up with more knowledge, resources, understanding, ideas, and hope. In time, the connections made can become more powerful than the connections MS destroys. To share information about MS or to donate time or money, you can connect with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society at msconnection.org.
And continuing on with the Connecticut section, just 3 months after announcing plans for full implementation of a 2021 law to erase misdemeanors and certain low-level felonies for more than 80,000 people near the start of this year, Connecticut officials have fallen well short of their promise, with only about 13,600 residents having their records cleared so far. A celebratory gathering in December was intended to mark the long-anticipated conclusion to delays with Connecticut's Clean Slate initiative. The automatic erasure of tens of thousands of low-level criminal records for a majority of Black and Latino residents negatively affected by laws passed during the so-called war on drugs. Connecticut's erasure system was going to identify more than 178,000 offenses from more than 80,000 people, officials said, and the vast majority of expungements would happen by the end of January 2024. But the Lamont administration recently notified Clean Slate advocates that only roughly 13,600 people have had their records cleared, which accounts for about 33,000 charges. Around 30,000 of the expunged offenses have been for misdemeanors, while approximately 3,000 are for low-level felonies. Aging data systems and inaccurate data are the reasons for the most recent delay, according to the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection, one of the agencies responsible for Clean Slate's rollout. The state now expects that another 65,000 people will have their convictions erased in the coming weeks, with the goal of erasing all eligible records dating back to the year 2000 within the next 12 months. The situation has caused confusion among Clean State advocates, given that much of the information about the delay did not come until they actively sought out answers from officials about the status of implementation, and that the information came just months after the celebratory news conference. They knew at the press conference that a clean slate would definitely benefit the majority of black and brown people who experience incarceration, because those are harsher punishments that we get as black and brown people, said Rodney Moore, who works with the Congregations Organized for a New Connecticut's Criminal Legal Reform Team, or CONNECT, a coalition of religious institutions behind the advocacy for a clean slate. That was the excuse the first time, that there was a data issue and we're having issues with IT and we've got to get these things right, and it was going to be taken care of, Moore said, but now we're back at it again. Rick Green, a spokesperson for DESPP, said the state officials underestimated the extent of the problems with the data system when the full rollout was announced in December. But under the direction of the new commissioner, Ronnell Higgins, Green said the agency is committed to providing more frequent updates about implementation. I think the advocates are in a position where they have every right to be wanting to get some clear answers here. This is a pretty important thing, Green said. We're talking about convictions that have stayed on somebody's record for a long time, and we have an obligation to move quickly and fairly on this. Despite strong opposition from Republicans and small businesses, House Speaker Matt Ritter predicted Monday that the legislature will pass one of the session's most controversial measures. I think that this year we'll get paid sick days done, Ritter told reporters. I do. With only 6 months left in the legislative session, lawmakers are looking ahead at the state capitol to determine which bills will pass before the short session ends May 8th. One of the top priorities for Democrats is an expansion of the state's law on paid sick days, as they seek to extend the law to cover all employers with one or more workers. Currently, the law covers employers in the private sector with more than 50 employees. If approved, the law would become effective October 1st, but would be retroactive to a year earlier in order for workers to start accruing the paid sick time. A 14-year veteran at the Capitol, Ritter understands the road ahead will not be easy for paid sick days. We think we have fashioned a House version. That's why there's a House version that we think accommodates some of the concerns that we heard last year, Ritter said. We hope. We'll see. It's going to be a tight one, though. I think we can get there. Some of our members who were a no have been willing to listen and work on it, so we'll see. The state's largest business lobbying group, the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, is opposed to the three measures that have been offered by House Democrats, Senate Democrats, and Governor Ned Lamont. The three bills have the same goals with relatively minor differences in implementation. The opponents argue that the mandatory paid sick leave would hurt small businesses and startups, particularly bioscience companies that are trying to get established. All three bills were passed recently by the Democratic-controlled Labor Committee on party-line votes of 8-4. The bills mandate that each employee must have at least 40 hours of annual paid sick leave. While these bills are very well-intentioned, a one-size-fits-all policy is not a solution, Ashley Zane of CBIA said in a recent testimony. The state should not be treating mom-and-pop shops on Main Street the same as multi-billionaire dollar corporations. Connecticut is already the eighth highest cost of doing business in the country. In his State of the City address Monday evening, Hartford's newly elected mayor, Ronan Arulampalam, had laid out his vision for the city, by championing youth recreation, housing, and violence prevention while making the case for his $623 million budget proposal. The speech, which lasted around 20 minutes, highlighted the new mayor's priorities for his first term in office. Ara LaPalem, the former CEO of the Hartford Land Bank, started off talking about housing, an issue he made central to his campaign last year. In February, Ara LaPalem launched a series of new initiatives aimed at cracking down on offending landlords and helping tenants dealing with unsafe and unsanitary conditions. We will work collaboratively with good landlords because if you are doing things the right way, maintaining your property and respecting renters, then you are adding to the fabric of our city, and we want you to continue investing here, Ara LaPalem said. But make no mistake about it, we will hold bad landlords accountable. So to those bad landlords hiding behind a maze of corporate structure, I've said it before and I'll say it again, we're coming for you. The city plans on creating a tenant liaison position to work with the city's 311 team in responding to calls and reports of poor living conditions made by tenants in Hartford on a 24-hour basis, including holidays and weekends. Judith Rothschild, the head of licensing and inspections, was named to the new position last month. In addition, with dozens of businesses added to Hartford over the last year, the mayor championed the creation of the new Business One Stop, the new all-in-one office, which will be part of the Department of Development Services and will assist current and emerging business owners and entrepreneurs in licensing, permitting, and other city processes. Don Chapman, a well-known business figure in the city, has been tapped to lead the new office. And my final story. The Bushnell Performance Arts Center in Hartford announced its 2024-25 Broadway series of musicals on Monday. The slate of shows for the upcoming season includes a Neil Diamond bio musical, A Beautiful Noise, that'll be October 1st to the 6th. The return of Disney's The Lion King, November 13th to December 1st. MJ the Musical, December 10th to the 15th, a radically rethought revival of Peter Pan, February 4th to the 9th, The Wiz, March 11th to the 16th, Some Like It Hot, April 29th to May 4th, 2025, and Back to the Future, the musical, June 4th to the 8th, 2025. The schedule breaks down to two jukebox musicals, two refreshed and reinterpreted 20th century musical classics, and three musical versions of famous movies, one of them from Disney. The Bushnell continues its tradition of hosting the first national tours of recent Broadway hits. Two of the shows, MG and Back to the Future, are still running on Broadway as their first national tours commence. The Broadway production of Some Like It Hot closed in December after running for around a year. The Wiz, a revival of the 1974 black version of The Wizard of Oz, is touring before it gets to Broadway, playing the Bushnell less than 3 weeks before it begins preview performances at New York's Marquee Theater. Besides the seven shows in the subscription season, the Bushnell announced return bookings of two musicals at the Bushnell. The other two, Peter Pan and The Wiz, first came to the Bushnell decades ago, but in very different forms. This new production of Peter Pan has been rewritten by playwright Larissa Fasthorse, Broadway's The Thanksgiving Play, with a particular interest in reworking the original script's objectionable depictions of Native Americans. Some Like It Hot is based on the 1959 comedy directed by Billy Wilder and starring Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, and Marilyn Monroe. It's not the first time the movie has been turned into a musical. A previous attempt, Sugar, by Jules Stein, Bob Merrill, and Peter Stone, ran on Broadway in 1972 and retitled as Some Like It Hot, played the Schubert Theater in New Haven in 2002. The new code has a score by the Hairspray and TV Smash team of Scott Whitman and Mark Shaman, and a book by Matthew Lopez and Amber Ruffin. Lopez has had several of his plays, including the world premieres of Somewhere and Reverberation, produced by Hartford Stage, was also commissioned but did not end up producing his Tony-winning epic, The Inheritance. Ruffin, best known as a writer-performer on Late Night with Seth Meyers and for her new defunct Amber Ruffin show on Peacock, also had a hand in the tour of The Wiz, adding new material to the book. The lottery numbers for Tuesday, March 26th, play 3-day, 2-1-3, WB7, play 4-day, 4-7-6-7, WB8. Monday's late numbers, play 3-night, 5-1-4, WB2, play 4-night, 5-5-1-2, WB2, cash 5 numbers, 6-8-18-19-25, lucky for life, 1-4-31-39-47, LB5, and the Powerball number 7-11-19-53-68.